Chapter 11. The robot touched a switch. A wall locker opened its sliding door, and Joe saw within complete sets of diving gear. Oxygen masks, pedal flippers, plastic skin suits, waterproof light sources, weights, pry bars, crossbows, oxygen and helium tanks, everything, including many assorted items of equipment which he could not identify. "In view of your lack of experience in deep-sea diving," the robot said, "I would suggest you descend by spherical prolepsis chamber. But if you want to suit up..." It shrugged. "I have no control over that. The decision is yours." "I've had sufficient experience," Molly said briskly. She began bringing equipment out of the locker. Presently, she had a formidable heap stacked neatly before her. "Get out what I got out," she instructed Joe. "Put the segments of the suit on in the order I'm putting them on, and in the same way." They suited up, and then, led by Willis, they made their way to the staging chamber proper. "Sometime," the robot said as it unscrewed the great plug valve in the floor of the chamber, "I intend to write a pamphlet on deep-sea diving. There is a basic assumption that the thonic world is in the ground. You find this in every religion. But in actuality, it's in the ocean. The ocean," it dragged the huge plug away, "is the actual primordial world out of which every living thing came a billion years ago. On your planet, Mr. Fernwright, this error is found in many religions. For instance, the Greek goddess Demeter and her daughter Kore, they come up from the earth." Molly said to Joe, "There is attached to your belt an emergency device in case of failure in the oxygen circuit of your rig. If you lose your air, if the conduit loosens or bursts or the tank runs dry, activate the hypo plunger of the belt unit." She pointed to the one mounted on her own belt. "It swiftly drops metabolic processes so that your need for oxygen is minimal. Little enough so that you can easily float to the surface before you suffer any brain damage or experience any other lasting physiological effect from the curtailed oxygen supply. When you float to the surface, you will of course be unconscious, but your mask is designed to let in air automatically. It will respond to the altered condition, the presence of outside air, and then I'll be up to steer you back here." "I must be gone," Joe quoted, trying to remember how it went. "There is a grave where daffodil and lily wave." The robot said, "And I would please the hapless fawn, buried under the sleepy ground. A favorite of mine, Yeats, I believe. Do you think, Mr. Sir, that you are descending into a grave? That what stands before you is death? That to descend is to die? Answer in 25 words or less." "I know what the Callan told me," Joe said somberly. "What I find in Heldskala will cause me to kill Glimmung. So it is into death that I'm going. Maybe not my death, but someone else's. To permanently halt the raising of Heldskala." Grimly, the words flowed within his mind, always at the surface, always available. They would not sink out of sight for a long, long time. Perhaps, he thought, never. "The stigma is upon me, and I will carry it the rest of my life." "I will give you a lucky charm," the robot said. Again, it rummaged within its chest pocket. It presently brought out a tiny packet, which it handed to Joe. "A token which represents the purity and sublimity of Amalita. A symbol, so to speak." "And it'll ward off evil influences?" Joe asked. The robot said, "You must say, Willis, will it ward..." "Willis," Joe said, "will this charm help us down there?" After a pause, the robot said, "No." "Then why did you give it to him?" Molly asked caustically. The robot hesitated. "Never mind." It seemed then to retract into itself. It became silent, distantly inert. "I'm going to lash us up in tandem," Molly said to Joe as she attached a cable from her belt to his. "This will give us 20 feet of free line. That should be enough. I can't risk getting separated from you. That might be the last we'd see of you." The robot wordlessly handed Joe a plastic carton. "What for?" Joe said. "You probably will find a broken pot or two down there, and you'll want to bring the shards up." Stalking cat-like to the aperture in the floor of the staging chamber, Molly said, "Let's go." She snapped on her helium-powered torch, glanced briefly at Joe, and then dived out of sight. The 20-foot cable attached to him stretched taut, pulled him. It walked him to the aperture, propelling him, and then, his mind blank of any real thoughts, he dived, too, passively. The light of the staging chamber faded out above him. He snapped on his own torch and allowed himself to be tugged along, down and down. The water became utterly black, except for the vague, seemingly half-real quadrant illuminated by his torch. And below him, Molly's torch glowed like the phosphorescent light of an exceedingly deep sea fish. "Are you okay?" Molly's voice sounded in his ear. It startled him, and then he realized that a two-way intercom connected them. "Yes," he said. Various fish floated past him, incurious and pompous. They gawked at him and traveled on, disappearing into the void surrounding his illuminated path. "That windbag robot," Molly said scathingly. "My God, we must have conversed with it for 20 minutes. But, Joe thought, we are here now, within the waters of Mare Nostrum, spiraling down and down. I wonder, he thought, how many theologically inclined robots there are in the universe. Perhaps Willis was the only one, put there by Glimmung to talk at extended length, thus interfering with the attempt to go below the surface. The heat unit of his suit snapped on. He felt the cold of the sea ebb away from him, and for that he gave thanks. "Joe Fernwright," Molly's voice sounded in his ear, "did it occur to you that Glimmung might have sent me here to go below with you as we're doing, to kill you? Glimmung knows the prophecy. Wouldn't it be reasonable for him to do that? So obvious. Didn't you think at all of that?" As a matter of fact, he had not. And thinking it now, he felt the chill of the ocean ease back into its grip around him. The enervating cold plundered his loins, his heart. He felt himself freeze within into frightened immobility, like a defenseless minor creature. His fear deprived him of his sense of being human, of being a man. It was not a man's fear. It was the fear of a small animal. It shrank him, as if devolving him into ages past. It eradicated the contemporary aspects of his self, his being. "God," he thought, "I am feeling a fear that is millions of years old." "On the other hand," Molly pointed out, "the text which the Kalan showed you might have been a forgery, prepared for your benefit. One single copy for your eyes alone." Joe said hoarsely, "How did you know about the Kalan and the new text?" "Glimmung told me." "Then he read what I read. It isn't a forgery for my benefit. If it was, you wouldn't be here." She laughed and said nothing. And on they spiraled downward. "Then I can assume I'm right," Joe said. Stark and yellow, the hull of something gleamed and putrefied within the focus of his torch. To his right, Molly's torch lit up another vertebra of it. Huge, like an ark that had been built to contain every living thing. And an ark which had sunk to the bottom of Mare Nostrum. Forever. The ark, he thought, a failure. "What is it?" he asked Molly.
"A skeleton."
"Of what?" He thrashed toward it, sweeping out as much of it as possible with his torch. Simultaneously, Molly did the same. She bobbed close to him then. He could see her face through the transparent plastic disc of her oxygen mask. When she spoke, her tone was subdued, as if, despite her knowledge and experience, she had not expected to find this here.
"It's a Glimmung," she said. "The skeleton of an ancient, archaic, long-dead, forgotten Glimmung. It's coral-encrusted terribly. It's been down here, I would say, for a century at least. Good Lord."
"You mean you didn't know it was here?" he demanded.
"Maybe Glimmung, not me. But,"
she hesitated,
"I think it's a black Glimmung."
"What's this?" Joe asked, and his uneasiness burgeoned. It filled him and became by degrees overwhelming dread.
"It's almost impossible to explain," Molly said. "As with antimatter, you can talk about it, but you can't really imagine what the words mean. There are Glimmungs, and there are black Glimmungs, always on a 1-to-1 ratio. Each individual Glimmung has his counterpart, his opaque doppelganger. Sooner or later during his life, he must kill his black counterpart, or it will kill him."
"Why?" Joe said.
"Because that's the way it is. It's like asking, why is a stone? Do you see? They evolved this way, on this strange parity basis. They are mutually exclusive, antagonistic entities, or if you prefer, properties. Yes, properties like chemical combinations. You see, the black Glimmungs are not precisely alive, and yet they're not biochemically inert either. They're like malformed crystals with the form-destroying principle motivating them, tropic specifically as regards their matching Glimmung. And some say that it's not limited to Glimmungs. Some say..."
She broke off, staring acutely ahead.
"No," she said. "Not this, not already. Not the first time."
A decaying hump of flopping fabric mingled with threads of cloth tottered toward them, propelled by the currents of murky water. It had a humanoid look, as if once, long ago, it had held itself erect, had walked on strong legs. Now it bowed from the waist, and its legs dangled as if the bones had been scooped out of them. He stared at it, and it came nearer, and he continued staring, because it seemed somehow to want to eddy into his vicinity, clumsily, so that its pace was slow. And yet it made progress forward. He made out its face now, and felt the world within him disintegrate.
"It's your corpse," Molly said. "You must understand, time down here is simply not..."
"It's blind," he said. "Its eyes, they've rotted away, gone.
Can it see me?"
"It's aware of you. It wants..."
She hesitated. "What does it want?" he demanded, snarling at her so that she shuddered.
"It wants to talk to you," she said then,
and became totally silent. Now she merely observed, merely saw, and did nothing in either direction. She did not assist him, she did not assist his corrupted corpse, as if, he thought, she has withdrawn and is not here. "I am alone with this thing."
"What should I do?" he asked her.
"Not..." She became silent once more, then abruptly said,
"Don't hear what it says."
"You mean it can speak?" he demanded, appalled. He could accept what he saw, he could retain his sanity when presented with his own dead body. But he could not believe beyond that. It could not be real, not sane. It had to be the mimicry of some aquatic life form, something which saw him and managed in a plastic manner to adopt the semblance of his own shape.
"It will tell you to go away," Molly said, "to leave this world, this ocean, leave Heldskala forever, and Glimmung's hopes, his project. See, it's already trying to form words."
The decayed flesh of the lower face writhed. He saw broken teeth, and then, from within the cavity which his mouth had become, noise issued forth. A drumming, as if far off on a heavy ocean cable. Something extending for 500 miles, something which weighed so much. Something so dense, so hard to maneuver. And yet the thing tried. The drumming continued, and finally, as it bobbed before him, rotating slow motion and rising now, then sinking a little, he distinguished one word, then another.
"Stay," it said,
and its mouth cavity gaped. Small fish floated in, disappeared, then floated skimmingly back out.
"You must go ahead. Ahead. Lift Heldskala."
"Are you still alive?" he asked it. Molly said,
"Nothing down here is really alive in the strict sense. Residual amounts, partial changes in a damaged battery."
"But it's not yet," he said. "This is the future."
"There is no future down here," Molly said.
"But it hasn't happened to me yet. I'm alive. I'm facing this ugly thing, this horrible mobile rot. It couldn't talk to me if I were it."
"Obviously," Molly said. "But the distinction isn't really complete between the two of you. Some of it is merged in you. Some of you remains in it. They are both you. You are both of them. The child is father to the man, remember? And the man is father to the corpse. But I thought it would say to you to go away. And instead he, it, wants you to remain. That's what it swam up here to tell you. I don't understand. This can't be your black in the sense that I was explaining it anyhow. It's badly decayed, but it's benign, and the blacks are never benign. Can I ask it something?"
He said nothing. Molly took it as silent assent.
"How did you die?" she asked the corpse.
The exposed jawbone waggled whitely in the currents of water surrounding it as it drummed out its deformed words, its answer.
"Glimmung had us killed."
"Us?" she asked alertly. "How many of us? All of us?"
"Us."
It extended a decomposed arm toward Joe.
"We too."
It became silent then, and by degrees drifted away.
"But it isn't so bad. I have a box I've made. It helps protect me. I get inside it and put up a barrier where the door, the entrance, is. And very few of the fish, the really dangerous fish, get in.
You mean you're trying to protect your life? Joe said. But your life is over. He did not comprehend. It made no sense, and it was eerie and bizarre. The thought of a decayed corpse, his corpse, living this semi-life down here, going through the motions of making itself safe. "Improve living standards for the dead," he said savagely, speaking at large to neither Mali nor the corrupted body floating before him.
"The curse," Mali said.
"What?" he said.
"It won't let you go. It confronts you with your own final self, and yet you won't go away. And then later on, when you're this..."
She gestured at the corpse.
"You'll wish you had left. Today, tonight, tomorrow morning."
"Stay,"
the corpse said to Joe. "Why?" he said.
"When Heldskalla is raised from the water, I will go to sleep. I am waiting to go to sleep. I'm glad you came at last. I have waited centuries. Until you come here and release me, I am caught in the totality of time."
It made an imploring gesture with its right arm and hand, but portions of the hand broke loose and fell away into the murky water. The hand now only had two fingers, and seeing this, Joe felt physically, substantially sickened. He thought, "If I could turn the clock back and not have come here..." But the corpse had said the opposite. His coming here meant its and his release. "My good Jesus," he thought, "I'll be that thing before long. Parts of my body will fall off and be snapped up by the dangerous fish. I will have to hide in a box down here at the bottom of the sea, and the fish will eat me piece by piece." "Or maybe it's not true," he thought. "Maybe this is not my corpse. How many people are confronted by their own corpse? A corpse talking beseechingly." "The Kalends," he thought. But that made no sense, because, contrary to Molly's expectations, it had urged him to stay, urged him to begin his job of pot-healing. "Glimmung," he thought. "This is a phantasm projected by him, a warped, a deranged hook to gaff me, obviously." He said to the bobbing, lingering corpse, "Well, thanks for your advice. I'll take it under advisement."
"Is my corpse here, too?" Molly demanded.
No answer. Joe's physical remnants had floated away. "Did I say the wrong thing?" Joe asked himself. "But ye gods, what are you supposed to say to your own corpse?" "I said I'd think its advice over. What more can it ask?" He felt strangely angry, not frightened any longer or horrified, just the mundane boiling inside him of irritability. Pressure like this, it was unfair. He had been told that he must go ahead with his part of the project. And then he thought of the curse. "Death," he said to Molly as they bobbed close to each other. "Death and sin are connected. That means that if the cathedral is cursed, then we also..." "I'm going back up." She rose, drifting upward above him, her legs moving expertly. "I don't want to find myself too close to the dredging operation." She pointed. He turned his body in that direction. An enormous silent instrument, a construct which he did not recognize, lay far to their right. He heard its activity now, the dull, low throbbing. Its sound had been there all this time, but he estimated in the form of a 20 cycles per second churning at the lower limit of audibility. Perhaps he had felt it as a vibration. Perhaps he still felt it that way now. "What is it?" he asked her, and started in that direction. It fascinated him.
"A Caprix scoop," Molly said. "Ionian Caprix, the element with the greatest atomic weight currently in use, replacing the older Rexoroid scoops that you used to see."
"Is the entire cathedral going to be raised by the scoop?" he asked Molly, who unwillingly flapped and dove beside him, following his course in a reluctant, halting manner.
"Only the base," Molly said.
"The rest is being cut into blocks?"
"Everything but the base, which is a solid slab of Deneb III agate. If it were sawed into blocks, it would be unable to support the superstructure, hence the scoop."
She hung back.
"It's not safe to go so close. Anyhow, you've seen Caprix scoops and shovels in operation before. You know the principle they utilize. The fulcrum is passed back and forth among the four rims of the scoop. Now, please, let's go back up to the surface. I find it very exacting down here. Damn it, it's dangerous so near the dredging."
"Are all the blocks cut?"
"Oh, God," Molly said wearily.
No, not all. Only an initial few. The scoop is not yet lifting the base. It's merely inserting itself in place.
What will the ascent rate be? He asked.
That hasn't been decided. Look, we're not ready for that. You're talking about ascent rate while we're still involved in getting the scoop in place. This isn't your field. You have no knowledge about dredging. The scoop is moving horizontally at the rate of 6 inches per 26-hour day, which is virtually not moving at all.
He said, there's something you don't want me to see.
Paranoia, Molly said.
Flashing his bifocal light source to the right of the scoop, he made out something, a dense and opaque mass that soared up high, becoming a triangle of planes past which fish swam and onto which barnacles and bivalves and a host of unipodular mollusks and crustacea clung. And next to it, where the scoop slowly worked, an identical shape held Scala.
That's what you didn't want me to see, he said to Molly. Two cathedrals.